Case 10-3604, Anthony Williams et al. Versus Duke Energy International Incorporated et al. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. DeMarco for the appellants.
I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Are your honors ready?
Sure. Three minutes rebuttal?
Yes, you're
very well.
Do your opening before your rebuttal.
I would be happy to. Thank you. By funneling payments through third parties, Duke Energy secretly gave, and for all anyone knows, may still be giving, millions in illegal rebates to its largest electric customers, without giving any rebates to its smaller customers. Plaintiffs maintain this is a classic violation of Ohio's anti-rebate statutes and the Robinson-Patman Act. Now, the rebate agreements, which are euphemistically called side agreements, were never filed or approved by the Public Utilities Commission. And everyone apparently agrees the Commission has no authority to enforce the anti-rebate statutes that those agreements violate. Yet the district court dismissed, holding that the Public Utilities Commission has exclusive jurisdiction over the side agreements. There's a world of irony here. I want to start with a quote that's in the record. Quote, side agreements quite simply fall outside the scope of proceedings before the commission. That's at RE 57, page 9. Now, you might think plaintiffs...
What's that from? Yeah.
That is from a brief filed in the Ohio Supreme Court by the Public Utilities Commission. It's as if we said it ourselves. Now, Duke, at the time that the PUCO was taking the position that it had no business looking at side agreements, Duke agreed. For 2 years, Duke fought to keep the side agreements away from the PUCO. They said the side agreements were none of its business. That, Your Honor, is at Record Entry 57, page 6. There's a cite to that brief. Yet when this case was filed by those smaller customers, Duke had suddenly changed its position. No longer did it argue that the side agreements were none of the PUCO's business. Suddenly, Duke maintained that the PUCO didn't just have jurisdiction over the side agreements, but it had exclusive jurisdiction over the side agreements.
Can you explain to me how this works in fact, that Duke is entitled to a rebate, but does that, in effect, a lesser charge for the electricity, or rate? Or, I mean, there's no money exchanged here.
I think.
How does it physically work?
I think Your Honor misspoke when you said Duke is entitled to a rebate. I have to preface this by saying
General Motors.
We didn't have any discovery.
The parties that withdrew their objections to the rate making process. You say they're now getting a rebate. How does that rebate actually work?
If you look at, let's take the General Motors example. You look at the General Motors agreement. It purports to give this non-utility affiliate of Duke the right to sell electricity to it. in exchange for which that non-utility affiliate is going to make payments to General Motors. But what's critical to understand about that is that the non-utility affiliate never had any customers. It never provided electricity to anyone. And yet, there's an email, and I'll give you the site to the email from Duke Energy that says it has $22 million in expenses. So it doesn't sell to anybody, but it's got $22 million of expenses. I hate to be
sort of a straw party that's selling this energy to through this straw party.
Yes, I hate to be so blunt in using this term, but it was a bag man, Your Honor. All it was doing was taking money from Duke. And where it got the money, we don't know, because Duke never refused to give discovery, and we haven't got that far. But the money was clearly being funneled over from Duke Energy to the non-affiliate, or the non-utility affiliate, and back to GM. Now, was it all, were they getting dollar for dollar? We don't know that yet. Part of the problem is, and why I say these things were done in secret, this is what Duke wanted the public to know about its rebate agreements. This is what, when it finally got ordered by the Ohio Supreme Court to show the rebate agreements to the PUCO, this is what it filed publicly. This is what its ratepayers know about that, those rebate agreements. So there's all this irony here. I think the third facet of irony is everything that Duke did was aimed at keeping these rebate agreements secret. Yet, the district court said as to the state claims, they are the exclusive jurisdiction of the PUCO, notwithstanding the comment that I read from the PUCO. And as to the federal claims, they said, the district court said, they were covered by the filed rate doctrine. Now, there's a third category of claims. That's the injunctive / declaratory relief claims. The district court said nothing about those. At the very least, those must be remanded under Square D and the distinction that was drawn there between damage claims and injunctive claims. There would be no interference, no filed rate doctrine applicable if what the court was doing was simply enjoining the future actions. There's no filed rate that even applies here. So injunctive relief is the bare minimum that needs to be remanded to the district court. But I want to start then with
what is the injunctive relief you're requesting?
The injunctive relief that we requested and that the district court never addressed was prevent the payment of rebates under the existing agreements and prevent the renewal of those agreements and prevent in any other way Duke from paying rebates. So it was very future oriented, as we said in our brief on the injunction.
Has Duke admitted paying rebates? Have we got that far in the case?
No, we haven't got that far in the case. Duke has said a number of things over time. To the Ohio Supreme Court, frankly, Duke's counsel lied about the existence of the side agreements. Once the side agreements came out because of a whistleblower action, then that case proceeded. To my knowledge, in that case, Duke never admitted that the agreements called for paying rebates or were illegal. I have never seen anything where Duke admits it. But as to the state claims, the initial problem with the district court's analysis is it applied the wrong test. The test that we cite is from the Allstate case, and it has two prongs to it, both of which have to be met in order to hold that the PUCO has exclusive jurisdiction. Prong number one is PUCO's administrative expertise required to resolve the disputed issue, and number two is the act complained of a practice normally authorized by the utility. To either question is answered no, then the claim is not within the PUCO's jurisdiction. Let me go to the guts of these state claims that raise the illegality of the rebates. Civil conspiracy, number four, and declaratory relief, number seven. In each of these instances, We are talking about anti-rebate statutes that the PUCO, everyone agrees, does not have the authority to enforce. So to the extent we're talking about their administrative expertise, the PUCO itself says side agreements are not what we do. The second is the Act complained of a pattern, a practice normally authorized by the utility. The whole purpose of the anti-rebate statutes is to say, no, utilities can't do this. And there's good reason for that. You don't want utilities, and this echoes over into the Robinson-Patman Act, you don't want utilities favoring certain customers over other customers in like circumstances. Consider what the district court said about this, which should have resolved the Allstate test. Quote, there is no gainsaying that 4905.32, which is the anti-rebate statute, which expressly prohibits rebates, is no longer enforceable by the PUCO as to utilities operating with market-based rates. That meant neither Allstate prong was met. That should have ended the discussion. Now, there are also state claims for fraud and state RICO. Those are millions of miles away from the PUCO jurisdiction. Under the Lazarus case and the Gary Phillips case, those things can be dealt with by a court. Courts have been spotting fraud for 600 years before the PUCO. As to the federal claims, the court applied the filed rate doctrine to those claims. And I want to talk briefly first about the Robinson-Patman claim. As I said, this is a classic Robinson-Patman violation. After all, Robinson-Patman came into existence because A&P Company was getting discounts that were not available to mom-and-pop grocers. Here, the small grocer plaintiff is Munafo. Munafo brings the Robinson-Patman claim here under Section 2A, seeks damages under Section 4A, and seeks an injunction. That's key. As I said before, the injunctive claim must be remanded. Now, Duke's argument is, well, the damages for that Robinson-Patman claim are going to be measured by the filed rate, because you're going to give the filed rate back to Munafo, give the filed rate to Munafo that it never got in the first place, but that Kroger, its chief competitor, got. That's wrong. First of all, the filed rate, there is no filed rate. The rate was never filed. They never filed the rebate agreements. Second, we're not challenging the amount of the rate. It doesn't matter to Munafo whether it's X, 10X, 20X. What matters is they gave the secret rebates to Munafo's competitor, Kroger. Munafo's damages don't flow from the rate it paid, but from the rebates that Kroger received. So, under J. Truett Payne, the damages test is not to give back or give to the disfavored purchaser what it didn't get in the first place. Rather, the Supreme Court said, the damages are the competitive injury that's thereby sustained. As Mr. Munafo says in his affidavit, he's threatened with going out of business because of being denied this. As to the filed rate doctrine, one final point. The doctrine is intended to protect the regulatory agency's authority from judicial interference and to make sure that some customers don't pay less than others. In order for the district court to apply it in this circumstance, it turns the doctrine on its head because Duke never filed the rebate agreements, and that fosters precisely the kind of discrimination that the filed rate doctrine was intended to prevent. And as to the justiciability and judicial interference prong, that also would not be defeated by denying application of the filed rate doctrine because, as the PUCO itself said, it has no business reviewing side agreements.
Thank you, Mr. DeMarco. Any further questions? You'll have your 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Joe Barrett for the appellees. Your Honor, I want to address the central dispute in this case and the central reason that plaintiffs' claims are mistaken is the statements we just heard, that the PUCO has no authority to enforce anti-rebate statutes and that it told the Ohio Supreme Court that it doesn't do side agreements. That's a very gross oversimplification of what's going on in this case and what goes on under the new regulatory regime. So let me just try to clarify.
Well, first of all, did they tell the Ohio Supreme Court that? What was quoted?
Your Honor, what they said was the purpose of the remand from the initial Ohio Supreme Court decision was to determine whether there had been legitimate bargaining over a stipulation that was relied upon to approve the first Duke Energy Ohio RSP. And on the remand proceedings, they said, the side agreements have no bearing on anything other than whether there was legitimate bargaining. We conclude there wasn't legitimate bargaining. We're throwing the RSP out, and now we're looking at a new RSP that was not the product of bargaining.
My question is the quote that Mr. DeMarco made from allegedly a brief filed by the Public Service Commission and the Ohio State Supreme Court, is that accurate or not?
I think he was characterizing. I don't know if he was quoting. I don't. I think.
You say he took it out of context.
I believe he's taking it out of context in this regard. They were saying in that setting, side deals for purposes of the issue that's been remanded to us don't matter because we've already decided there was no legitimate bargaining and we've thrown out the original RSP.
So even if they said that their jurisdiction doesn't include such side agreements.
They didn't say that, Your Honor.
No, if they did, you would disagree with that. You would say they do have jurisdiction over side agreements.
I would say that they do have jurisdiction over side agreements. The Ohio Supreme Court has said that, and the PUCO itself has said that. In the same brief there's the remand proceeding order where the commission said, we can consider the side deals for any other purpose. We've reviewed them for the sole purpose relevant to the remand. They, in their brief to the Ohio Supreme Court, they then said, if the Office of the Ohio Consumer Counsel believes that there were discrimination or unlawful discounting going on here, they should make a case, and they have a available complaint procedure under 4928.16 and 4928.18. So that gets to the nub of the statutory confusion that I believe Mr. DeMarco was.
How can they make a case if they get a document that is all blacked out?
Your Honor, counsel said that there was no admission that the contracts ever existed. All of these contracts were turned over in the PUCO proceedings. There was redaction of confidential trade secrets, and the Ohio Supreme Court upheld those redactions. But there was the PUCO had the unredacted versions in front of it. But I just really want to stress the statutory scheme that we're operating under here. Two anti-rebate statutes that existed in the old regime, 4909.32 and 33A. There's no dispute that the PUCO no longer enforces those provisions as to competitive retail electric services. But fundamentally, it retained authority to enforce 4909.35, which prohibits a utility from giving any undue or unreasonable preference to any firm or person. That is an anti-rebate, anti-preference, anti-discrimination provision still enforceable against Duke Energy Ohio. It also was given authority to enforce a policy saying the competitive retail electric services must be provided on a non-discriminatory basis, and Duke Energy Ohio is under an obligation to provide services on a comparable and non-discriminatory basis. All of those things prohibit discrimination. Plaintiff's whole theory for why the commission actually lacks authority at this point is an untenable expressio unius claim that because the old provisions use the word indirect and the new provisions don't, that somehow that means that these new provisions I've just mentioned don't cover indirect discrimination. And that's utterly implausible because the provisions I mentioned don't say direct without using the word indirect. They say any undue preference, and they say no discrimination. They are broadly stated prohibitions. And there is no case law at this site that stands for the proposition that the broad powers of a regulatory body entrusted with protecting the public interest can be narrowed on the basis of any such expressio unius doctrine. More fundamentally, the PUCO has said, as I just mentioned, that it has authority to hear complaints of discrimination arising out of these very contracts, and the Ohio Supreme Court has said the same thing. In its 2009 decision, it said, issues including unlawful discounting and unlawful discrimination arising, and was referring to these exact side deals, can be brought before the PUCO.
Has Duke admitted that it's been given rebates to some of these customers?
It absolutely has not, Your Honor. It does, there's been no discovery of this. I'm not here to serve as a fact witness, but it views these contracts as entirely legitimate arbitrage deals in which...
What kind of deal?
They're essentially, Your Honor, a form of an arbitrage. So Duke, DERS, the contracting party, is betting that rates will rise, and if they rise a certain level, then they will lock in that customer's business and they will be able to sell at a profit to itself. And the customer is betting that rates will stay where they are or fall, and they'll be able to collect the option payments without having to take the service. That is my understanding of these arrangements and why Duke believes they're legitimate. But as I said, there's been no testimony, there's been no discovery, so I'm not asking the court to rule on those assertions.
That was in place before the Public Utility Commission.
The Public Utility the plaintiffs have declined to bring such an action, and I don't know whether the OCC ever followed up. But the point is that the authority is there. The authority is there under the three statutes that I just mentioned. The PUCO has invited claims of this sort based on these very contracts. The Ohio Supreme Court has confirmed that those claims can be brought. And that where the PUCO has authority, that authority is exclusive, and it forecloses any state law claims. And there's just, we cited legions of cases there. The test, Mr. DeMarco says the test is not satisfied here, the Allstate two-part test. The first prong is, does the PUCO have expertise? He bases that they don't, again, on the idea that they disclaimed it, but as I've just explained, that's not true. And if there's anybody that has the authority and the expertise to determine whether these new contracts, these contracts by DERS, are pro-competitive and will help foster a new competitive market, or constitute illegal rebates and undue preferences, that is in the wheelhouse of the PUCO's authority to determine. And it is not for federal courts to determine. In addition,
aren't these agreements similar to the agreements that we all know about from reading about the mortgage market in terms of betting against and betting for prices going up and down?
Your Honor, whatever these bets are have no bearing on any third parties. We're not talking about gambles that were made by people on Wall Street that then devastated homeowners.
Theoretically, that if somebody won big or lost big, it wouldn't impact.
I don't see how, Your Honor. If the rates went up,
who's funding these bets?
Your Honor, Duke Energy Retail Services is a subsidiary of a Duke Energy Holding Company. I don't know the entire structure. All the holding company structure is regulated by the FERC and the SEC. And the relationship between DERS and DEO is regulated by the PUC pursuant to Section 492817, which requires that the companies be fully separate and requires the implementation.
Who regulates what they're doing if they're a fully separate entity?
Your Honor, if there's a claim that they have violated their separation agreement, the PUCO has authority to determine that, and it can regulate that.
Well, what if the claim is that the agreements are weighted one way or the other?
Weighted in what direction, Your Honor? I don't understand the question.
Either to make sure they win or to make sure that they lose, thus causing a disparity.
Your Honor, the fundamental point here is there is a regulatory body with full authority to address all the questions that you're asking.
Which
about.
Is the regulatory body that addresses
PUCO.
That? They do more than just regulate as to whether they're fully separate then.
But if one is being used as a shell corporation, it has authority to address that under 4928.17. If there is legal rebates going on, it has authority to be either out of one pocket or the other. It has authority to regulate that under 4909.35, which says no undue preferences or privileges, and under the anti-discrimination provisions I just mentioned, 4928.02, 4928.06, 4928.14a. So there is ample and exclusive jurisdiction within the PUCO to regulate these issues. And if I may turn to the filed rate doctrine questions, I was on the Allstate test, I just want to make my point. Plaintiff's theory that unauthorized conduct fails the second prong of the test can't possibly be what that prong means, because everybody alleges that the utility has done something wrong, and if you take it literally and say you're not authorized to do things that are wrong, the PUCO is divested of all of its authority over utilities. The test is whether or not the conduct is conduct that a utility engages in, and whether it violates a PUCO statute, that is for the PUCO to determine, and that's exactly what you had in the Duke Energy v. Hamilton County case, where the allegation was an unlawful termination of service, and the Ohio Supreme Court said that falls within the authority of the PUCO, not because unlawful activity is authorized, but because it has authority to determine whether the conduct was or was not legal. On the filed rate doctrine, Your Honor, the key case to bear in mind here is the FirstCom case. Plaintiff's whole argument here is the rebate agreements were never filed. The filed rate doctrine doesn't apply to side deals that are not filed. FirstCom addresses exactly the situation. In FirstCom, the plaintiff said, I had to pay a filed rate. So just like the plaintiffs here, there was a rate on file. It was the one that the plaintiff had to pay. The plaintiff said, I was injured because the utility, Quest, gave impermissible sweetheart deals, including discounts, to my competitors, and I was driven out of business. After several months after that company was driven out of business, the Minnesota State Attorney General sued Quest for failing to file those rebate agreements, those side deals, and it imposed millions of dollars in penalties. The facts are indistinguishable in this regard. And the Eighth Circuit said the filed rate doctrine bars your claims of competitive injury, just the same type of consequential damages that Mr. DeMarco alluded to. Why? Two reasons that are fully applicable here. If you get damages, you will end up paying a lower effective rate than what was on file with the Utilities Commission. The filed rate doctrine uniformly prohibits that result. Second, your theory is that you were injured because you didn't receive something that you claim you should have been you were entitled to, but actually doesn't appear in the filed rate. That's exactly what plaintiffs are saying here. They say they were legally denied, in paragraph 28, we were illegally denied rebates that were extended to others. You look at the RSP, there were no rebates in that rate. And so the theory that the courts have consistently said, if your allegation is that the misconduct of the defendant expanded your rights under the filed rate, then that violates the filed rate doctrine and that claim is barred. On injunctions, first of all, the rebates are alleged to be discounts off of the RSP. The RSP expired 3 years ago, so the claim is moot. But more fundamentally, the claim is not exempted from the filed rate doctrine. And this is another oversimplification. If you look at the Georgia versus Pennsylvania Railroad case, if you look at the Seventh Circuit's decision in Arsbury, the reason injunctions were allowed to go forward in that case was because in both, the courts looked to see whether the regulatory body had authority to address the allegedly unlawful conduct. In Georgia, the Supreme Court said, the ICC has no authority to prohibit or regulate the horizontal price-fixing conspiracies by railroads. And it stressed the absence of that jurisdiction before it said that claim could go forward. Seventh Circuit said the same thing in the Arsbury case, where it noted that the FCC couldn't regulate the conduct. And so when the agency lacks authority over the underlying conduct, you don't have any concerns with the non-justiciability prong. And, of course, if the relief is forward-looking, it doesn't affect the non-discrimination prong. Here, for all the reasons I've been describing, the PUCO has plenary authority to address claims of discrimination and illegal rebates. It has said it has that authority. The Supreme Court has confirmed that claims of unlawful discrimination and unlawful discounting can be brought before it. That avenue is open, and where, in these circumstances, the non-justiciability prong of the filed rate doctrine flatly bars injunctions as well as damages, because it would trench on the expertise of the regulatory body, and it would not allow it to exercise its expertise, which is vastly superior to that of federal courts or state courts, for that matter. I just want to make sure. I think I've addressed all the points. Again, Your Honors, I would urge you to take a look at the context in which the statements that Mr. DeMarco highlighted by the PUCO were made. Again, we were talking about a situation in which they were saying we have a limited purpose on remand. Our focus is on, was there legitimate bargaining? If not, is this rate legitimate under the 4928-14A standards? And it said, we've looked at the side agreements for the first purpose. We've concluded there's no legitimate bargaining. As to the second purpose, they're irrelevant. That is not a determination or a statement that if you bring claims of illegal discrimination and bagman kickbacks, we have no authority, our hands are tied. Quite to the contrary, in its brief to the Ohio Supreme Court, it said we would invite those claims through a proper proceeding in the Ohio Supreme Court.
How does the Public Service Commission have special expertise in claims involving bagman kickbacks?
Your Honor, that's, of course, plaintiff's characterization of what's going on.
That's just what you said. I mean, I just...
I'm sorry.
Okay, where's the expertise on that kind of a claim?
The expertise here, well, Your Honor, I would note that the expertise here is we have contracts by an affiliate, and this is the initiation of a new competitive scheme that the PUCO is supposed to shepherd into existence. And the allegation is by the plaintiffs, these are just bagman kickbacks. And we haven't gotten to the merits. Our view is that's not true.
We don't know because we don't have any discovery, and all we've got is there allegations in the complaint.
But if there's some illegality, there's no question that that the PUCO can remedy it and can declare it illegal.
How is that within their field of expertise, illegality?
Because
it seems like more of a judicial adjudication than administrative rate fixing.
No, Your Honor, because the fundamental question is this a rebate off of the rate? And they have expertise to determine what is the rate, and they have expertise to determine whether there is sufficient separation.
What else could it be?
It could be a legitimate contract between DERS and its customers, as of the sort I just described. And that's exactly, because there are two characterizations, that's exactly within the expertise of the PUCO. It can decide, is this an illegal rebate, or is it a legitimate contract? And as part of that inquiry, it can determine whether or not the companies are operating as separate entities as the PUCO.
The SEC was going to look into that.
Your Honor, the rule, I said that the PUCO could decide whether the DERS and DEO.
I understand that, but you said the SEC has some jurisdiction.
The SEC has jurisdiction over the holding company's relationships, and to the extent the money was coming from one of the upstream holding companies, he would have authority over that. With respect to relationships between sibling affiliates, there's the sibling affiliates of DEO and DERS. That's squarely covered by Section 492817's corporate separation requirements, detailed regulations that the Commission has issued to implement that provision, and within the complaint authority of the Commission under 492817.
Any further questions?
No.
Thank you, Mr. Burr. Mr. Marco, you've got 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I invite the court to review not just the statement that I quoted, but I think six or seven others in footnote four on page four of RE57, other statements from the Public Utilities Commission. In fact, I think Mr. Guerra is coming very close to a line that the district court called Duke on by suggesting that these side agreements are really business of the commission. In document number 93, the district court issued an order to show cause why Duke should not be held in contempt. And this is what it called Duke to account for the quote from the PUCO was, the side agreements were not before the commission for approval and therefore did not present any matters for the commission to adjudicate. It called them of secondary importance to the issues before the commission. Now, the whole notion that the PUCO has the special expertise in spotting frauds or bagmen, that's ridiculous. That is the work of courts. Courts were doing it for 600 years before the PUCO.
Do you have a citation for that?
I would start with Old English law if I have one, Your Honor, but
okay,
shams
on.
And frauds are businesses of courts. They are not the business of the PUCO. As even the PUCO says, because when they were forced to take a look at the agreements, all they did was to say, did these have any effect on the stipulation that was presented to us? They threw out the stipulation. They never, as the district court said, passed on the legality. Now, as to whether or not we should be forced to pursue other complaint processes that would entail asserting other violations of other statutes that may be involved here. Your Honors, we came before a court of competent jurisdiction. The United States Supreme Court says that district courts must exercise jurisdiction given to them. There's no question of diversity jurisdiction here. We raised a claim for declaratory relief under state law and asked the district court, did Duke violate 4905.32 and 0.33A, and it is not an answer, as Mr. Guerra says, to say, well, you should have asserted other statutes in your declaratory relief claim. That's ridiculous. I've never seen a court dismiss a declaratory relief claim because it believed the plaintiff should have asked for declaratory relief on another point. As to the filed rate doctrine, all that that we want to point out in closing is that this is not a situation where the filed rate was at issue. Contrary to what Mr. Guerra says on the Robinson-Patman claim, I want to reiterate, the measure of damage is not to give you the rebate you were denied. It is to compensate you for competitive injury suffered totally apart from the rate. It has nothing to do with the rate. If Mr. Munafo's business was destroyed, those would be his damages.
Any Thank you. Questions? All right. Case will be submitted.